Karl Marx famously wrote that capital comes into the world dripping from head to foot, from every pore, with blood and dirt. He also argued that the beginnings of capitalism were largely made possible by colonialist barbarity, the, quote, extirpation, enslavement and entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, and he was talking here of Latin America, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins. Yet Marx and his collaborator, Frederick Engels, had little or nothing to say about the resistance and fate of the indigenous peoples of North America and of this continent, now known as Australia. And sometimes they were just plain wrong. Despite this, their fierce hostility to racism and their analysis of capitalism inspired the early Communist Party of Australia, this country's first significant Marxist party. And Communist Party members were to blaze an anti-racist trail in the early 1930s of solidarity with Indigenous struggles that we can still learn from today. Today my guest is Paddy Gibson. Paddy is a member of Solidarity who works at the Jumbunna Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at UTS, the University of Technology in Sydney. Paddy has recently completed a PhD thesis on the relationship between the Communist Party of Australia and Indigenous struggles in the 20s and early 30s. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naarm or Melbourne. So, Paddy, welcome.
Good morning, comrade.
So, first up, can you tell us about why you started researching this topic?
I mean, I'm an active socialist. I've been a member of Solidarity since the early 2000s, the campaign against the Iraq War. And I've done a lot of Indigenous rights solidarity campaigning in particular. So as an organisation, we responded to the Northern Territory intervention back in 2007. And got very involved in a campaign. There was a lot of Aboriginal-led organisation at this time and also a lot of solidarity from non-Indigenous people to oppose, you know, the horrific racist Northern Territory intervention policy that we don't have any time to go into detail about today. But that really set me on a track of being centrally involved in protest movements for Aboriginal rights, and I've been doing that for about 15 years now. So I've thought a lot about the relationship between struggles for Indigenous rights and broader struggles for justice, and particularly the working class movement and the whole process of working class revolution that Solidarity advocates for, that we're attempting to lay the basis for and organise for. So I've thought about these issues of, you know, on what basis should socialists organise when we're taking up issues of black rights and of Indigenous rights in this country. I'm very interested in the history of those movements and how Indigenous people and workers' organisations have combined forces. You know, throughout Australian history, it's been a very, very important unity on the left between Indigenous struggle and the trade union movement and the workers' movement. You can see at high points of working class struggle in Australia is often when you also have breakthroughs by the Aboriginal rights movement, really harnessing the power of the workers' movement, and vice versa. The Aboriginal rights movement has helped to radicalise and expand the horizons of the broader working class movement in this country. So I've always been very interested in that history and wanted to look back at the emergence, really, of this phenomenon. You know, when was it in Australian history that workers' organisations started to actually take a stand for Aboriginal rights? Why was that? And particularly, I'm interested in the question of how do people break with the racist ideas that are hegemonic in society? So the ruling class in every country, but particularly in Australia, relies very heavily on racism to divide the population that they rule over, to justify their claims to territory, to justify their imperialist warmongering. And those ideas are everywhere. They saturate the press, they saturate our education system, and those are the dominant ideas. You know, as Karl Marx said, the ruling ideas of any society are the ideas of the ruling class. But people can break with these ideas. People can, you know, develop alternatives based on the common humanity, based on the need for solidarity and common struggle. And what's very interesting, I think, is when and where that happens. You know, why is it that for most of history, people accept the racism of the mainstream, but at particular times, you get alternative ideas emerge and break through and take hold. So that really, yeah, led me to look at the early history of the Communist Party in Australia, how they developed a position of solidarity with Aboriginal people. And that necessitated actually looking at the ideas of Marx and Engels, because these are the two great socialist thinkers of the mid and late 19th century in Europe, whose ideas were really foundational for the socialist movement worldwide and for the global communist movement that emerged after the First World War in particular. So Marx and Engels were very influential on the early Communist Party. The Communist Party very often carried excerpts from the works of Marx and Engels in their press, promoted books and pamphlets by Marx and Engels, and held reading groups on those texts. So it was quite important in terms of understanding the development of the Communist Party's thought to come to grapple with the nature of Marxist thought, and particularly what Marxism had to say about questions of racism and imperialism. So, you know, that's what set me off on this research project. And it was, you know, it was wonderful actually to be able to get the opportunity to have the time and space to go back and look so thoroughly at this, you know, really, really very, very interesting and inspiring history.
Now, as you say, Marx and Engels were critical, were founders of modern socialist theory in the 19th century, but they were real people, they weren't superhuman, and their thinking was impacted by the circumstances in which they operated. And you've argued that their case against colonialism and racism evolved over time. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that's what's the thing that I just learned the most, actually, looking at this history, was the extent to which, you know, the texts of Marx and Engels, which are very often, I think, read or understood divorced from the historical circumstances in which they were written. It is the case that in the socialist movement, there's a bit of a history, I think, of almost treating them sometimes as holy texts, you know, like here's these brilliant geniuses who came up with these fantastic ideas that are, you know, infallible and are really the foundation of all good thought that we have today. I mean, that's a bit of a caricature, really, perhaps not so fair, but I think there is, you know, that's a bit of that spirit and that history, particularly with the rise of Stalinism, consolidation of these texts, you know, far more into dogma. You know, so there's that sort of view, but what was really interesting going back and looking at it is looking at just how dynamic their writing and their work was and just how influenced it was by the struggles of the time. I think what you can really say is that Marx and Engels were organic intellectuals that were connected so closely with revolutionary workers' movements in Europe. And it was out of those movements that they actually got their ideas. It was by generalizing the best insights of activists on the ground, of the movements on the ground, who were making breakthroughs in terms of understanding the world around them and in terms of how they could build power and solidarity. And the role that Marx and Engels often played was to generalize those ideas and to get them into a theoretical written form. So some of the most dynamic development in Marxist thought came in the early 1860s, when he was elected to the leadership of the International Workingmen's Association, which was otherwise known as the First International. This was an organization which brought together socialist groups, anarchist groups, particularly the new big powerful trade unions and guilds that were developing in Britain, but also on the European continent. All of these groups came together in the International Workingmen's Association, the First International, and the leadership of this organization had leaders from the struggles, had trade union leaders, mostly were very influential, or, you know, leaders of protest movements and other things. And then Karl Marx was elected as he's a pure intellectual, right? So he wasn't a worker in a factory, but he was recognised, you know, as being a leader of the workers' movement and was elected on that basis. And he often drafted the resolutions, or, you know, drafted the letters that were coming from the International Workingmen's Association. So he was really, you know, providing an expression for and articulating the best ideas that were fermenting within the International Workingmen's Association. And it was in this period that you saw some of the most profound breakthroughs in terms of understanding the importance of the workers' movement standing against British imperialism in particular, but European imperialism generally. Marx was very inspired by, in the 1850s, and Engels was as well, anti-colonial rebellions in India. There was it's called the so-called Sepoy Uprising, a massive rebellion led by Indian army officers, actually, that had been brought into an army and armed by the British to try and control the colony in India, had developed a national consciousness and united with a mass movement to basically rise up and try and throw out the British in the 1850s. At this point, Marx wrote to Engels and said, India is now our greatest ally, recognising that the struggle coming from India was challenging the power of the same British regime that was putting down workers' struggles on the streets of England. So there was a recognition that there was a common enemy that was being fought, and that power could be built by building solidarity between, you know, what was going on with the Indian uprising and what was going on in Britain. I mean, it was at a very low level. There wasn't direct contact at this point with the Indian independence movement, but there was journalistic articles and other things written about why this movement is so important, you know, and why we actually need to be on the side of the Indian revolutionaries. The same is true of the uprising in China at this time, in Algeria at this time. There was a recognition that these were challenging the same power structure that workers were fighting against at home. And then in the 1860s, you know, you had a very serious development of a theory about why revolutionary workers needed to stand with movements for national self-determination. And what really posed the question for the International Workingmen's Association was actually the Fenian struggle, the Irish independence struggle. You know, Britain presided over a horrible colonial regime in Ireland, you know, suffering the terrible famine, the widespread killings, the oppression, a long-standing colonial oppression of Irish people. There was also huge numbers of Irish workers actually in British metropolitan centres. So the factories in London, the factories in Manchester, the factories, you know, in other metropolitan centres in Britain had very large populations of Irish workers who'd had to leave Ireland because of the poverty and oppression in their own country and seek work in Britain, only to be subject to terrible racism that existed because of the British colonial occupation of Ireland. So the occupation of Ireland was justified by basically arguing that Irish people were subhuman. You know, that they had lesser intelligence, that they couldn't manage their own affairs, that they needed actually to have British imperial control. This is the common pattern throughout history, is that imperialist regimes dehumanise the peoples that they are ruling over. But this racism also profoundly divided the workers' movement inside England, because British workers in the factories were buying into the racism they were getting, as Marx said, from the press, from the pulpit, from everywhere in British society, was sort of pumping out these ideas about Irish inferiority. Marx actually argued that the British ruling class, that this was the secret of their power, was being able to divide British and Irish workers with this racism, and that they would artificially inflame the divisions and the tensions that existed in the British working class in order to maintain their power. But Marx also said that the crucial way that British workers were going to be able to break their allegiance with British capitalism and with their own rulers was to identify with the Irish struggle, was to reject the idea that they had something more in common as a superior English race with their own rulers than they did with their common workmates that they were struggling with day to day in the factories. And building that workers' solidarity of the British and Irish workers united together for their own conditions actually required British workers taking a stand to say, we are against British imperialism. They needed to reject the racist ideas, and they also needed to demonstrate to their Irish workmates that they were a reliable ally, that they were a source of solidarity against the British. So There was bombs went off actually in London from Fenian independence fighters, and a whole lot of Irish revolutionaries were rounded up and jailed. And then there was huge demonstrations, you know, both in Dublin and in London, calling for the release of the Fenian prisoners. And the more far-sighted British workers were at the front of those demonstrations. So the British workers who were militant, who were political, they understood that they were being divided from their Irish workmates by the ruling class. They understood that British rule in Ireland was brutal, just like the conditions they suffered in the factories was brutal. And they actually joined their Irish comrades on the streets in their thousands. We're talking about demonstrations of like 100,000 people in London at this time, calling for freedom for Irish political prisoners. So Marx argued at the time that the International Workingmen's Association had to support these demonstrations lock, stock and barrel and be behind them and call for Irish independence. And this meant sort of challenging the idea that was coming from some anarchists and from some others that we shouldn't get involved in national politics, you know. The workingman has no country was a line in the Communist Manifesto that was thrown back in Marx's face to say, why do you care about an Irish national identity? Aren't we all just workers? And Marx was arguing, no, in order to build unity, we actually have to be clear that Irish are oppressed as a nationality and they have a right, you know, to national self-determination. And this was a very, very profound insight that came to play a central role in the revolutionary struggles right around the world in the 20th century with the emergence of the Communist International after the First World War, and their position of complete unconditional but critical support is the way that Communist International put it for national liberation movements. This comes directly out of Marx's writings on Ireland and out of the movement of the International Workingmen's Association in solidarity with the Irish independence struggle. So I've gone into a bit of detail there about the Irish question. There was actually quite a lot also going on at the time in terms of the development of Marxist thought. But I think that's probably the best and clearest, or one of the best and clearest examples of how it was out of the real struggles on the ground that you had this theorization about the importance of anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism and anti-racism. It didn't, you know, fall from the sky, or wasn't just, you know, a fantastic idea someone woke up with one day. It was in response to real living, breathing struggles of thousands and thousands of people trying to fight for freedom in the world that they were living in.
That's a very impressive record of understanding and taking on racism. And yet, despite that, the great Palestinian writer Edward Said has dismissed Marx as an Orientalist, implying that he is centred on the struggles of Europe and minimises or patronises the struggles of the Middle East and beyond. But you've argued that this fails to recognise major developments in Marx's thought. So why is that?
Yes, I think that, I mean, and this is something that's, you know, consistently put forward as a critique of Marxism, that it's Eurocentric and essentially racist, you know. And there is a basis for this argument in some of the early writings of Marx and Engels, which I think didn't properly appreciate the nature of imperialism and colonialism. Edward Said, he quotes some writing that Marx did about India in the early 1850s, for example, or would be able to quote some of the writings that Engels did in the late 1840s, which, you know, I could quote from as well. I mean, I will just read actually one quote from Engels in 1848. This is the same year that they printed the Communist Manifesto. So, you know, we already have Marxism, you know, as a very dynamic and living political philosophy at this time, with a very clear articulation of the need for proletarian revolution. At the same time, 1848, Engels writes about Algeria. The conquest of Algeria by the French is an important and fortunate fact for the progress of civilization. The modern bourgeois, with civilization, industry, order, and at least relative enlightenment following him, is preferable to the feudal lord or the marauding robber with the barbarian state of society to which they belong, right? So this is part of an idea that capitalism and the expansion of capitalism around the world, even though it might have been brutal, it was actually progressive and historically necessary because, you know, you've got all these backward forms of social organization in the barbarian world. And by the French conquering Algeria, they would be bringing the ideas of the Enlightenment and progress and would be bringing capitalism to a backward society. And this would lay the basis for the emergence of the potential for a socialist society, right? So that was the idea. And I think we can say that this idea was wrong. It was racist. It required accepting ideas about the backwardness of, you know, of colonized people. And it did qualify for the sort of Orientalist category, I guess you'd say, that Edward Said, you know, developed when he was looking at Western political thought. But that wasn't the whole story, because those ideas changed. So if you did just want to take a snapshot from the late 1840s or early 1850s, you can find things that you could allow Marx or Engels to be characterised as Orientalist, I think. But the important point is that those ideas actually changed. And why did they change? They changed in response to real struggles in the real world. And that's the important thing that I think we have to look at and that we actually have to learn from. So the change started in their thought actually in the wake of 1848, when there was a mass revolutionary movement in Europe, including in the home country of Marx and Engels in Germany, right? Or wasn't Germany at the time. I mean, they were arguing for the formation of Germany, but living under the Prussian monarchy. You know, at the time, there was this revolutionary movement of workers rising up, and they thought that the same pattern would happen in Germany where they were, that happened in France with the French Revolution, where the bourgeoisie would play a progressive role leading a mass struggle, a popular struggle against the monarchy in order to establish a republic that established greater rights for the vast majority of the population than what they enjoyed under feudalism. They thought the bourgeoisie would play this sort of progressive historical role in Germany, which didn't happen. The bourgeoisie turned out in Germany to be more scared of the mass movement of workers that they would actually need to defeat the vestiges of feudalism in Germany. They were more scared of the workers than they were of feudalism. And they ended up lining up with, actually, the Prussian regime to massacre the workers' movement that had risen up in 1848 in an attempt, you know, to establish a democratic society, and massacred, you know, drowned in blood, really, the 1848 revolutions. And there was an exodus of revolutionaries around the world. A huge number of Germans went to the United States after this. And we can talk a little bit about the legacy, you know, of some of the German revolutionaries who went to the United States and remained in contact with Marx and Engels. But you got a bit of a shift in the thought of Marx and Engels at this time, actually, when they grapple with the reality that the bourgeoisie are not actually going to play this same role that they thought that they would play after the French Revolution across all of Europe, that they were more interested in stability and gradually developing capitalism and gradually developing their own rights under, you know, within the womb of the feudal society than they were in actually confronting it and trying to overthrow it. And I think you can see the emergence at this time of a more critical attitude to the bourgeoisie and the idea that the bourgeoisie would now continue to play this historical role fighting for greater freedoms. And it translated into a far more critical view of the expansion of bourgeois domination around the world. Whereas earlier in 1848, as I said, there was an argument in favour of French colonisation of Algeria. By the end of the 1850s, that had flipped around, and Engels is actually writing in praise of Algerian independence fighters. They recognise that actually standing up to and fighting back against bourgeois imperialism created more space for the revolutionary workers' movement in Europe, because they were fighting against the same enemy. And they, you know, had sort of dropped or began to break with this idea that the expansion of capitalism and imperialism around the world was somehow historically progressive or historically necessary, and came to see resistance to that expansion as an important part of revolutionary struggle. If you just look back at some of the stuff they wrote in the late 1840s or early 1850s, yes, you can pull out things, you know, that do read as though they're pro-colonial. But by the late 1850s, and certainly by the 1860s, those ideas had flipped around. They were in favour of revolutionary movements in the colonies, and they developed a very clear critique explicitly of racism as well. The experience of the American Civil War and the struggles of slaves both prior to and during the Civil War also played a massive role in this. I mean, one of the main reasons that the Confederacy in the American South was defeated in the Civil War was because there was a massive uprising of slaves themselves who left plantations in their hundreds of thousands, absconded towards the North, and really crippled the ability of the Confederacy to fight. Right, Marx and Engels recognised the incredible power of the black uprising that had ended slavery, and the way that this didn't only strike a blow against the Confederacy, but also opened up the ideological horizons of white workers in the United States. In Capital, you can say Marx actually wrote, "In the United States of North America, every independent movement of the workers was paralyzed so long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor cannot emancipate itself in the white skin where in the black it is branded." And interestingly, that quote appeared all the way through the Communist Party of Australia's writings in the 1920s and 30s. It was a very influential quote. "Labor cannot emancipate itself in the white skin, where in the black skin it is branded. If we accept the racist division and subjugation of black people, no workers can be free." You know, but Marx goes on to write, "Out of the death of slavery, a new life once arose. The first fruit of the Civil War was the 8 hours agitation that ran with the 7-league boots of the locomotive from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California." So out of the experience of the mass mobilization for the Civil War and the anti-racism that was very much part of that mass mobilization, you got a new lease of life for the US workers' movement, who went on to fight for their own interests, for the 8-hour day, in new multiracial unions. I mean, it wasn't perfect. There was still certainly some racist rules in some American unions, but there were a lot of unions that threw their ranks open to black and white workers, and you had united struggles of black and white workers right across the United States, fighting, you know, for rights, for the 8-hour day and for other things out of the Civil War. So again, it was the experiences of struggle that really informed the development of the theory about why workers need to take racism seriously, why we need to fight racism. And I think if you ignore the development of the thought, then you really miss, you know, the dynamic aspects of Marxism and what Marxism represents, which is a living theory of struggle, not something that's, you know, sort of written down and true for all time. It's something that evolves. It's something that moves with the struggle. And you know, Edward Said's, you know, sort of writing about Orientalism and Marx sort of just doesn't recognize that or misses out on that important sort of dynamic feature.
So Marx and Engels developed, as you outlined, strong and clear positions against colonialism in India. They understood the importance of fighting racism towards Irish people, both in Ireland and in Britain, and they were champions of the struggle against slavery in the United States. So that brings us to this really interesting contradiction, which is explored in your research, which is that Marx and Engels had a blind spot about what we've come to know as terra nullius, the racist idea that the land on this continent and also in North America belonged to no one before the invaders arrived. So how could they be so clear on the need to fight colonialism in, say, India and Algeria and Ireland, and actually have a blind spot about what was happening here and in the United States?
Yeah, I think that this was a really interesting phenomenon when I went to actually look at the writings of Marx and Engels, because as I've said, there's so much in there that is very powerful and dynamic in terms of a contribution to our understanding of colonialism, racism and imperialism. But they wrote a hell of a lot about North America because they were in contact with American revolutionaries. As I mentioned before, a whole lot of German emigres went to the United States and played a very important role in the workers' movement in the United States. As early as the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels are writing, or even earlier than that, actually, Marx and Engels are writing correspondence, you know, with revolutionaries in the United States, advising them on, you know, strategic questions and political questions. And as I mentioned, the International Working Men's Association, it had branches, you know, in the United States, as well as, you know, across the European continent and Britain. So they were there was no shortage of commentary from Marx and Engels about the political situation in the United States. But I think One thing that really constrained their writing, I guess, and the insights from their writing about the nature of US imperialism and US colonialism came out of the weaknesses of the movement. So as we've been over, the best insights come out of the strengths of the movement, come out of high points of struggle. They don't just fall from the sky, or they're not just some great ideas someone woke up with. They're reflections of real living people fighting back against the system and what the ideas are that are being generated in that process. The structural position of US workers in the United States as settlers in an imperialist process where the US colonies were expanding and taking land from indigenous people, it was that structural position that actually blinded the US workers' movement to the realities of indigenous suffering, the violence that was being perpetrated, the genocide that was being perpetrated against native people in the United States. And that blind spot in the movement in the United States, you know, meant that Marx and Engels, you know, had nothing to go on. You know, there was no solidarity between US workers and native people who were fighting the encroachments on their land. Actually, to the contrary, a big part of the early US workers' movement was calling for the release of lands across the American continent for settler workers to take up 160-acre lots. You know, this was seen as a way to escape from capitalism. Capitalism is an exploitative system that forces us into factories and alienates our labor. What's an alternative to this? An alternative to this is to go and set up a small farm on the frontier where you can have autonomy, where you can have some freedom, where you can have some control over your own life. Like, this was actually the vision of the early US socialist movement. There was an organization in the 1840s that was called the National Reformers League, which called explicitly for the division of the entire American continent for working class Europeans to take up settlements, you know, on the American continent. And in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels say that in the US, you could, because there isn't as developed a working class, you can only get socialism expressing itself in an agrarian form, is the way they put it. And the representatives of this movement are the National Reformers League. And so therefore, communists should cooperate with the National Reformers League and try and take forward their struggle. Because it was a struggle, they saw it, and certainly did have this quality on the ground as well, between small farmers, you know, working class and poor people who are European who want land, right, and big commercial interests, big industrialists who wanted to take land for their own use, like the railway companies, or big agricultural companies that wanted to take land and run it on a mass sort of commercial basis, you know, or big ranches or other things like this. So they perceived there to be a conflict between capital, if you like, big capital trying to get big tracts of land for capitalist purposes, and small holdings, small workers who wanted to just take the land to have a bit of freedom and have a bit of autonomy. So the struggle over land in the United States was never once discussed in the writings of Marx or Engels as a struggle between an imperialist force, the United States, that was expanding across the continent and taking land by killing indigenous people, which is the reality of what was happening. It was never discussed in those terms. It was discussed as being a struggle between the small farmer and the big capitalist, right? And the socialist should be on the side of the small farmer. So there's that politics in the US workers' movement that really influences Marx and Engels in terms of what they're writing about at the time. But the other thing is just the point that I made at the start of this talk is the intensity of the anti-Indigenous racism that was hegemonic at that time. The ruling ideas basically cast Indigenous people in North America as somehow subhuman, that they were backward, that their mode of production was so backward that they were historically doomed to just die out, right? That was the dominant idea. And those ideas were accepted. Those ideas were widely accepted by everyone, including workers and including revolutionaries. And where is an alternative going to come from that's actually going to break those ideas and put forward an alternative? Well, as I've outlined previously, that alternative is only actually going to come out of struggle. That's only actually going to come out of real people fighting back. But there wasn't the conditions in North America at that time. And in fact, there was this structural position where, you know, where workers could go to the frontier and take up land. So were settlers in that imperialist process that really stopped and blinded the, you know, the emergence of solidarity with Indigenous people. So you got no challenge to the anti-Indigenous racism actually coming from the workers' movement at that time. And so it wasn't expressed then in the writings of Marx or Engels. So in Capital, for example, Marx actually writes a whole chapter towards the end of Capital, where he, I think it may even be the final chapter, where he looks at the struggles over land in the United States and in Australia. And it talks about this struggle between the small settler workers and the big interests, right? And he says, these people who think they can go to the frontier and escape capitalism are fools, right? You can't escape capitalism. You might go to the frontier and take up land, and that might be a safety valve. They called it a safety valve for the system to be able to release lands on the frontier and send oppressed workers out to the frontier. They might be able to have this safety valve where they allow settlement to happen for some time, and workers might think that they can escape the drudgery of the system by taking up land. But at the end of the day, it's a capitalist state who's going to turn around and dispossess those workers and give that land over to big capitalist interests. That's already happening in the United States. That's already happening in Australia. There's nowhere to hide. You can't go to the frontier and hide. You're going to have to deal with capitalism. You're going to have to confront it, and you're going to have to overthrow the capitalist state in the final analysis, right, if we want to actually become free. So that was a very correct argument that was made in Capital by Marx. But what was completely missing was that there was already people who were resisting the encroachment of capitalism, Indigenous people fighting an anti-colonial war across the frontier, both in the United States and in Australia, not anywhere on the same scale as the uprisings that we saw in India. So that's another point here, is we're not talking about the sort of mass movements of millions of people that characterized, you know, national liberation struggles in the 20th century, or for that matter in the 19th century. These are small scale battles that were happening, but nonetheless very real resistance to imperialism that was missed. That was just completely missed. And, you know, Australia is discussed as being virgin soil and public lands, and the United States is discussed as being virgin soil and public lands, and it's just discussed as though there's no Indigenous people there at all, as though it's empty. And that was really the ideology of the time. So not making a case here that Marx and Engels were like particularly racist or were in favour of anti-Indigenous violence or anything like that. But the point I'm trying to make is there was a hegemonic ideology which said these people are fading out and are just going to die anyway, so we don't even need to think about them. And their land is just public land now that's a conflict between, you know, the small-scale settler and the bigger industrial capitalist. That's the only thing that matters. You know, this is an ideology of terra nullius, that it's empty land, and it does find expression, you know, sort of in those writings. Yeah, so that it was just, you know, going back and actually having a read of it, it's quite striking, I think, that you've got this, you know, really serious anti-imperialist position that's emerging. I'll just make one more point on that, actually, is that Marx is actually corresponding with the US workers' movement in the 1860s, writes a number of letters to major US workers' organisations such as the National Labour Union, where he argues that even though the Civil War was justified and it was necessary to put down the Confederacy and defeat slavery, he warns against the United States consolidating a standing army that would turn into an imperialist force. And he says that it would be creating chains for the workers. If we allow them to create a standing army in the United States that can act as an imperialist force, this will be used against the workers' movement. And so workers need to oppose, you know, the drive to war that happened, you know, after the Civil War. There was a lot of discussion in the United States. It looked like they might go to war with Britain at one stage, the US sort of entering the international arena as a new power on the world stage. Marx says it's up to the workers' movement, you know, to command peace when your rulers would have you make you have war. You know, it's up to the workers' movement to ensure that there's no standing army that's consolidated in the United States, because that will be a reactionary force that will be used against the workers. Now, what Marx didn't realize at the time, or certainly didn't write about, was that the American army was already being consolidated both during and after the Civil War as an imperialist power that was fighting against indigenous peoples across the American West. And that what he warned would happen, that if they allow the US to consolidate a standing army, it's going to be used against the workers' movement, is exactly what happened. In the 1870s, there was a number of insurrectionary strikes in the United States, mass strikes, and the army was deployed, redeployed from the Western Front, from the fights against indigenous people across the Western Plains, to cities such as Chicago to put down the workers' movement. All the way through the late 19th century, this phenomenon played out. So he was right that if US workers allowed America to establish a standing army, it would eventually be used against them, but he didn't realize that that was already happening in the mid-1860s and didn't fight, and the American workers' movement, to their own detriment, didn't fight against the expropriation of indigenous lands. American workers never got, you know, didn't enjoy the fruits of indigenous lands in the way they argued that that would happen with something like the Homestead Act brought in by Abraham Lincoln, which divided up huge amounts of indigenous land and you know, ostensibly to give to working class people. This was a safety valve that got a lot of support for Abraham Lincoln, for example, was this sort of policy of the Homestead Act. In reality, after about 10 or 20 years, most of that land is in the hands of the big industrialists, is in the hands of the big capitalist farmers. Exactly what Marx said would happen, happened. So it didn't turn out to be in the interest of the US workers' movement to, you know, go and dispossess indigenous people. But they thought it was in their interest. They didn't have a critique of the US. They were a bit enamored of the whole idea of US republicanism. It was certainly far more progressive, or so they saw, than what they had on the European continent, where you still had monarchies. They looked at the US republic as a bit of a beacon of democracy, but this blinded them to the reality of the anti-Indigenous violence and the dangers of allowing the US to consolidate into an imperialist force in the way that it did. So, you know, it was very interesting, you know, sort of looking at that, and tragic, really, where you can see that, you know, they're sort of on the cusp of having an analysis or having the tools to be able to argue for why that sort of solidarity would be important. But the weaknesses of the workers' movement at the time meant that it never got that kind of expression.
I would recommend anybody listening who wants to get a feel for the remorseless, cynical and racist dispossession of the indigenous peoples of North America to read the classic Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, because that takes you through step by step the way in which American capitalism destroyed the autonomy and sovereignty of the indigenous people of the United States. But let's move on to Australia now, because although Marx and Engels focused a lot on the United States for reasons you've outlined, some of the same weaknesses also applied to their analysis of Australia. But what is most heartening is the way in which the Communist Party here, which came into existence in the 1920s, in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution of 1917, is the way that the Communist Party was both inspired by Marx and Engels, but simultaneously overcame some of the limitations of that analysis that you've just been running through. Now, a detailed discussion about how the Communist Party blazed an internationalist trail with their support for indigenous struggles, particularly from the early 1930s, is another episode in its own right, and we'll record that at another time. But in the fairly short time we've got left, can you nonetheless give us a snapshot of how the best of Marx and Engels' writings informed the party's anti-racist practice?
Yes, certainly. I might just quickly, I'll just make one comment about one other aspect of Marx and Engels' writings that did have an impact on the Communist Party, and then go into talk about the Communist Party. And that was you know, Marx and Engels didn't really write much about Australia at all. So there's, you know, while there is books actually filled with writing on North America, you know, that as I mentioned, didn't talk about Indigenous people, talked about this struggle between the small farmers and the bigger capitalists was most of their concern. They didn't really write about Australia, but they did apply the same analysis to Australia. Well, Marx did, at least in Capital, towards the end of Capital, where, as I've said, he discusses Australia as virgin soil and public land, and there's no acknowledgement that there's still Indigenous people here, and they're being violently dispossessed. And, you know, as I've said, that was a function really of the strength of anti-Indigenous racism that was hegemonic at the time. Marx did, however, write quite a lot about Australia, or at least made little notes about Australia later in his life. In the late 1870s, Marx becomes really obsessed with studying ethnographies from all around the world. So this is the early, what became, you know, they consider themselves a science of anthropology in the 20th century. The roots of this are in these sort of ethnographies that were written by would-be social scientists in the sort of 1870s and 1880s. Marx was devouring these, right? And he had a critique of those ethnographies. And it's really interesting the way he actually challenges their anti-Aboriginal racism. So there's examples in his notebooks, these were never published, but there's examples in his notebooks where he's writing about racist assumptions that anthropologists are making about Aboriginal people in Australia, and actually arguing that the Aboriginal people that they were talking to had a superior state of mind to the anthropologists. So, you know, he gives one example, he extracts a passage from the British ethnologist John Lubbock, who was arguing for the spiritual superiority of the higher races. And Lubbock cites another author's account of a friend in Australia who was trying in vain to convince an Aboriginal man about the existence of a soul that could leave the body and ascend to heaven. Marx actually mocks Lubbock as a fool and calls his friend an ass. And he contrasts this with the intelligent black who would not keep his countenance. So the Aboriginal person who's rejecting this idea of a separate soul that's going to go up to heaven, you know, he's saying that, you know, this Aboriginal person's got superior intellect and ideas actually to the anthropologist. So there's some really interesting twists and turns in Marx's notebooks where you can see that he's fascinated by the different ways that people have organized society around the world and throughout history, right? He's very interested in the different political forms that existed, you know, in the colonized societies and in their relationship with the natural world as well. And you can really see in these notebooks, he's sort of trying to imagine what life could be like outside of the capitalist reality that they're living under in England, you know, trying to experiment with, well, there's plenty of ways that humans can live. We don't have to exploit each other. We don't have to exploit the natural world. Look at all these different societies all around the world and the different ways they've done things, right? So he's getting a lot of creative sort of thought from looking at Indigenous societies and the way they're sort of organising themselves around the world. And it's very, very interesting. And you can see clearly pro-Aboriginal, actually, in some of the notes. Now, after Marx passed away, Engels got a hold of these notebooks and saw and realised that this was actually quite an important part of Marx's intellectual work in the later stage of his life. And he used one set of notebooks in particular, Marx's notes on an American ethnologist called Louis Henry Morgan. Engels used Louis Henry Morgan to basically provide the foundation for the book he writes, Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State, which looks at basically the development of class and the development of the state and family forms and particularly women's oppression over the course of human history. And there's a lot in Engels' work that was groundbreaking and remains very important today, particularly about the fact that women's oppression is not something that's natural, it's something that's imposed, and it's something that's imposed when class society emerges. Anyway, I don't have time to go into that today, but I want to make the point. There's a very important kernel of truth in Engels' work. However, Engels' work was extremely uncritical of the very racist anthropology that Louis Henry Morgan was actually undertaking. So Louis Henry Morgan argued that Aboriginal people were like representative of the lowest stage of humanity, and actually argued that they were in some ways biologically inferior, and that it was only by changing their family form to make sure that there was no incest taking place. This is what explains the development of societies away from the backward hunter-gatherer life of Australian Aborigines. You know, in other parts of the world, people advance beyond this, and even advance beyond this biologically and intellectually, and develop the tools and, you know, mental capacity to be able to have agriculture and other things, right? So it's a very racist argument, and I think it shows the strength of anti-Aboriginal racism at the time. As I said, Marx's notebooks were actually quite critical of these ideas. Engels just took them on and reproduced them when he wrote Origin of the Family. So there's an interesting phenomenon when I was looking at the Communist Party of Australia, where, as I mentioned, Marx and Engels' work is foundational, right? Absolutely foundational. So they're always quoting Marx and Engels. They're quoting Marx and Engels to show how workers are exploited, quote Marx and Engels to show how women's oppression's not inevitable, how colonialism's bad, how racism's bad, as I mentioned, you know, quoting that thing about, you know, labour can't be free in the white skin while in the black it's branded. They wielded this quote, you know? So they look to Marx and Engels for tools to challenge the dominant ideas of the society they were in. But when Australian communists went and read Engels on Australian Aboriginal people, they're reading all this racist stuff that ethnologists had come up with in the late 19th century, essentially to justify Aboriginal dispossession, and they're sort of thinking that this is Marxism. So Australian communists grow up in a society where anti-Aboriginal racism is absolutely everywhere. You know, this horrible genocidal racism that these people are so backward, they're mentally inferior, they're doomed to disappear. That's the mainstream philosophy that's pumped into everyone in Australia. Unfortunately, there was actually nothing within socialist writing at the time about Aboriginal people that provided any counter to this. So it's not like they went to Marx and Engels and read an alternative and said, well, here, look, we've got an alternative to this. You know, they went away and read Engels on Aboriginal people, some of the leading intellectuals. And in the 1920s, they tried to justify what Engels was saying and tried to say, look, Engels was right, and the latest anthropology confirms what Engels was saying, and there's these sorts of articles in the communist press. By and large, though, in the 1920s, they just ignore Aboriginal people entirely. So they accept this idea that they are so backward, they will just disappear. That's the mainstream ideology, and there's no challenge to it from the socialist movement. That changes, right? That changes from the late 1920s, and it changes for the precisely the same reason that I've argued that you get a change in, you know, the racism of the workers, you know, movement, and a challenge to that racism in response to anti-colonial struggle in the 1860s in Britain. It changes because communists start actually fighting alongside Aboriginal people and start to realise in struggle that all these mainstream ideas about these people being inferior and backwards are actually rubbish. They start to identify with Aboriginal fighters who are challenging the police, who are still encroaching on tribal lands in the north of Australia. They start to, you know, in the Depression in particular, it's very interesting. In the Depression in New South Wales, a lot of unemployed white workers suddenly find themselves on the fringes of town where Aboriginal people have been camped for decades, right? They're excluded from mainstream society, they're on the fringes of society, and they have these fringe camps, and suddenly white people are also on the fringes of society because they're all unemployed in mass numbers, and there's no, and they're mixing with Aboriginal people in these unemployed workers' camps, and you actually get the emergence of a pro-Aboriginal position and an anti-racist position out of this common experience of struggling against the deprivation of the Depression. And once they start struggling, once there actually starts to be a fight alongside Aboriginal people, then the general ideas that Marx and Engels had had and that the Communist International had had about the importance of the politics of self-determination, about the importance of unite and fight, black and white, get together and fight the boss, about the importance of challenging the racism that goes along with colonialism that casts people as inferior, all of these general ideas that had been very strong in the communist movement are applied by communists in Australia to the Aboriginal situation, you know, and they're inspired. It needs to be said, it's Aboriginal people themselves fighting very hard against the racism and marginalisation they experience that provides the inspiration for communists in Australia to start developing this theory. So in particular, there was an Aboriginal organisation called the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association. It was actually led by working class people, wharfies, train drivers, right, factory workers, Aboriginal people who were connected to their own reserve communities and started organising in Sydney and up and down the East Coast for their own interests in the mid-1920s. This organisation was ignored by communists initially, but when they started fighting alongside Aboriginal people, the ideas of the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, who were calling for self-determination and an end to the controls of the Protection Board and other things, these really, really inspire a small number, but it's still quite important, of Australian communists who go on to theorise the position of Aboriginal people in Australia. So I think that that sort of confirms again, you know, the main idea I've been trying to get across in this interview and in my thesis, the common sense racism that's pushed by our rulers is accepted by the overwhelming majority of people in a society until you get a fight back, until you get struggle. And in struggle, you can develop alternatives and the alternatives start to flower. And that was really the case, you know, in terms of the Communist Party, you know, coming to apply Marx and Engels' insights to basically go beyond what Marx and Engels were capable of in their own time when there was no movement of solidarity.
It's a fantastic story. And as I say, we'll come back and later this year we'll record another episode of The Sound of Solidarity and look at what the Communist Party did on the ground in the late 20s and early 1930s alongside Indigenous communities and fighters. But we're coming to an end now, so I suppose just to summarise, today it's pretty much a given that the socialist left supports Indigenous struggles for self-determination. So is studying Marx and Engels still helpful for us today?
Oh, look, absolutely. I think, you know, as I said, it's been so important for me in terms of struggling the, you know, emergence of their thought to really understand, you know, this point about the relationship between, you know, development of radical ideas and the realities of radical struggle. Like that's a really, really, you know, I think important point. But I think there's a real anchor, you know, in Marx and Engels, regardless of the weaknesses that they had at the time and even the racism, you know, that was expressed, you know, sort of at the time, you know, in some of the writings. There's this very important anchor to what they argue, which is that all of these barbarities that we see in the system, the killing, the genocide of people in colonized countries that's condemned in Capital, there's long passages about the, you know, incredible violence and, you know, and genocide that was carried out, you know, all around the world by the expanding imperialist system, the system of slavery, all of these, you know, sort of processes of oppression. They have their root in capitalism. They have their root in a particular mode of production that develops, you know, initially in Europe, but, you know, from the start as a world system. From the start, capitalism requires imperialism, the exploitation of colonies, raw materials from the colonies, slavery, right? All of these injustices have their root in the emergence of capitalism as a global system. And how do we smash capitalism? It's through workers' revolution. You know, that's the insight of Marx and Engels about the actual power that workers have to be able to take collective control of the productive system and to smash the capitalist state. That remains as important now as it was back then. And I think, you know, we've learned so much more, you know, since that time about the incredible contribution that anti-colonial struggles can play and need to play, and anti-imperialist struggles need to play, you know, against if we're going to bring down this system around the world. We've learned so much more. There's been so many inspiring national liberation movements. There's been so many setbacks, failings, you know, so much to learn from the whole history of struggles against racism and national liberation. But I think really having that anchor and the eyes on the prize that, you know, if we're going to overthrow the system, all of these struggles need to unite into a revolutionary struggle. And, you know, workers of the world, regardless, you know, of our colour, of our nationality, of our gender, you know, we all have an interest and we all have a potential power to come together and overthrow the system. That remains as important today as it did when Marx and Engels, you know, were writing. So, you know, I think it's really interesting looking at the, you know, the development of these ideas over time, the experiences of revolutionary movements. You really can't understand what the Communist Party was able to achieve also without understanding the Russian Revolution and the way that the insights of Marx and Engels that I've discussed today were massively augmented by and developed by the global communist movement in the early 1920s in the Communist International. We haven't had any time to go into that today, but you can't understand what the Communist International was able to achieve without looking earlier in the lineage of the development of these ideas. And I think you can't understand the forces we remain up against today and how we can deal with them, how we can fight them, and how we can overthrow them, you know, without that fundamental grounding in revolutionary politics and revolutionary working class politics. So, you know, it's just as important today, you know, to read those texts. And as I've said today, urge people to understand them in their context. They're far more interesting in their context. And they're far more interesting when you think about what the relationship was of these living, breathing revolutionaries and what they were doing every day, who they were speaking with, what demonstrations and meetings they were going to. You know, that's what explains the ideas, and that's where I think we can learn so much from.
Thank you very much for your time, Paddy.
Thank you. Thanks, David.